Major funding for the series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Crossing East. Our stories, our history, our America.
And some people do call this the Ellis Island of the West. It was, you're tired, you're poor. And Angel Island was known at the time as the guardian of the Western Gate.
One year they say you're white, but not Caucasian. And the next year they say you're Caucasian, but not white.
And so it makes these people who are nationals into alien. They lose this kind of elevated status above alien.
The laws out of 1996 was targeted at welfare reform. And it was clear that America was telling the immigrants that we don't care about you and that we blame you for our welfare ills.
I'm George Takei. When we return, Exclusion and Resistance on Crossing East.
I'm Dime Roberts with the Crossing East music feature. In Japanese, taiko means big drum. Taiko is also the name for Japanese drum ensembles all over the world. In North America, there are more than 150 taiko groups and growing. The birth of North American taiko came in the politically charged year of 1968. The same year Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated, Zaichi Tanaka banged the big drum in San Francisco and started American Taiko. Jeannie Aiko Mercer and Russell Baba of Shasta Taiko met each other while studying with Tanaka. They were instantly drawn to taiko and now have their own taiko group in Mount Shasta, California.
I had moved to San Francisco from Anchorage, Alaska in about 1969. It was very thrilling because I've never seen, you know, a Japanese musical art form so dynamic. One of the things that attracted me to it was the fact that there were quite a few women in the group. To me, to see women going all out and being so physical and creating music at the same time was very appealing to me.
Growing up and seeing all the war movies constantly and the Japanese were the enemy, that had maybe affected me and a whole generation of young people. My stereotype of Japanese were that they were very quiet, didn't rock the boat. And then when I saw taiko, or when I went to Japan and saw festivals there or talked to Japanese nationals, they weren't quiet. In some ways, they were loud and told you their opinions.
I was born in an internment camp in Minidoka in Idaho, so I don't really remember anything of the experience. And then, of course, after the war, I think it's true of all Japanese Americans, our parents, particularly the Nisei, you know, wanted us to be American, so we weren't really taught or exposed to really Japanese culture. I think the act of playing taiko is in itself sort of political in a way because, you know, you are educating people and, you know, we did perform for a lot of, and we still do, in fact, for things like pilgrimages, you know, to Tule Lake, for days of remembrance kind of things.
Before I was awakened, you know, because of the Vietnam War and the Asian movement, etc., political movements, and I was a student activist. Truth was in music. For me, when I play, that says everything. You just hit the drum, and it's like I'm drumming in your face. It's who I am. This is my color. This is what I look like. This is what I'm playing.
The finances are always tough, but that's, I think that's true for everyone. But we do manage to survive here. People really appreciate what we do. I mean, there are very few Asians. We are increasingly seeing more and more. It's mostly a white population.
You know, it was like a calling because we know how much it meant to us. We still struggle here, but we realize that drumming and that kind of activity is essential in any community, especially here when I see so many people hurting, that they're searching for something, and when they find something like taiko, it really makes a difference in any person's life.
The taiko drums themselves are made out of wood and animal skins and air. when you play the taiko, you try to connect with all those spirits. It's something almost sort of primordial in a way. I've been doing it for, 33 years now, so that says something, I think. Like now I'm considered a senior citizen, you might say. But, you know, I think taiko has kept me young. And, yeah, I'm going to continue to do taiko as long as I physically can.
Jeannie Mercer and Russell Baba continue to tour the country and hold classes through Shasta Taiko. Their son Masato, a student of taiko since the age of 6, performs with the On Ensemble and Taiko Project in Los Angeles. For more information, go to crossingeast.org. This Crossing East music feature was produced with Sarah Caswell Colbert and is made possible by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
I'm George Takei, your host for Crossing East. Our stories, our history, our America. We present Exclusion and Resistance, Chapter 1, Yellow Peril, by John Kalish.
Hello, Peppy. I feel lucky. Just had a little cup of sake. Yes, oh, that's my baby. No, sir. Not meaning maybe. Yes, oh, that's my baby now.
Comic singer Harry Stewart made a living performing as the stereotypical Harry Carey in the 1950s and 60s. This recording is part of a collection of Asian Americana at New York University. The collection shows how Asians have been viewed as the perpetual foreigner in America. Professor Jack Chen runs NYU's Asian Pacific American Studies Institute.
Even though they may be American citizens, they've always been represented as the foreigner. Sometimes as a good foreigner, the friendly foreigner. Sometimes the Japanese are our friends, and sometimes the Japanese are our evil enemies. Sometimes the Chinese are that way. Sometimes the Koreans are that way. And it's constantly flipping back and forth.
White Americans of the late 19th century expressed their fears of an Asian invasion with the term yellow peril. This fear led to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. It formally barred Chinese immigrants from entering the United States, the only time one racial ethnicity has been excluded from the U.S. But many other laws targeted immigrants before that.
1790, Nationality Act. Only free white persons could become naturalized U.S. citizens.
1854, People versus Hall, ruled that Chinese could not give testimony in court.
1862, California anti-coolie tax on the Mongolian race.
1882, Chinese Exclusion Act. Only Chinese merchants, teachers, students, diplomats, and tourists were allowed to come.
The Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed in 1943 as a goodwill gesture to China, a U.S. ally during World War II. At the same time, all Japanese Americans on the West Coast were detained in internment camps. Exclusionary and discriminatory laws thrived in the 19th and first half of the 20th centuries, preventing Asians in America from becoming citizens and owning property, or revoking the citizenship of American women who married Asian men. Always, there was the fear of the yellow peril. From 1892 to 1924, 20 million immigrants were welcomed to America through Ellis Island of New York City. But on the other side of the country, at the Angel Island Immigration Station in San Francisco Bay, thousands of immigrants faced detention for weeks and months. Tour guide Casey Lee.
And some people do call this the Ellis Island of the West. When people think of Ellis Island, they get a very romanticized view of immigration. You have the Statue of Liberty that right next door, welcoming people, give us your tired, you're poor. And Angel Island was known at the time as the guardian of the Western Gate.
From 1910 to 1940, during the time that the Angel Island Immigration Station was in operation, Asian immigrants were locked up in stark barracks, and many endured lengthy interrogations by officials. This was not the welcome most had envisioned. Chapter 2, Angel Island, by Demay Roberts and Michael Johnson.
The fog bell clangs, and a group of 50 children exit down a ramp from a ferry to the Angel Island immigration station in San Francisco Bay. For 30 years, Angel Island was the entry point for close to 175,000 Chinese immigrants. Now it's a national park where tourists and students can explore a dark time in American history.
The gate up here used to lead to a covered walkway, and it would go directly to the mess hall.
Erica G., education director of Angel Island, wends her way through a maze of barbed wire fences leading to a series of yellow wooden barracks.
And essentially with the covered walkway is that once immigrants went inside the administration building, they pretty much didn't go outside again. And so most of the time they really were inside, and they didn't really have free access outside.
Immigrants from throughout the Pacific passed through Angel Island, but it was the Chinese who were detained for anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 years. Families were split up and underwent medical examinations. Then they were housed in separate quarters.
Women were held in this room probably in the first 2 to 3 years of the operations of the immigration station.
We pass through a dark hallway and enter a gray room with no curtains. G points to rows of metal bunk beds stacked three on top of each other.
You know, these people were living in very close living quarters. Women and men were separated. Women traveling with children would also have their children with them. If boys were traveling with their mom and they were about 12, 13, or 14, boys would actually be housed with the men. So for kids, this is a really scary thing. Imagine, you know, traveling and suddenly being separated. You had to go with all these men now.
G says that health code inspectors set a maximum number of 60 people to be housed in this room, but she says they always exceeded that. Everything in the room is a shade of gray, even the walls and floors. It's hard not to think of it as a dorm room in a jailhouse. The men's quarters, located in a separate building, are bigger. More men immigrated. The people housed in these barracks never knew how long they would be detained or if they were going to be deported.
So the men who were housed here would pretty much be in here all day. They would go downstairs to that mess hall, down the covered walkway, and they would go for breakfast, they would go for lunch, and then they would go maybe for a snack in the afternoon, and then a dinner. You ate your meals, you might have a time outside, but the majority of it was spent in, confined into one room with lots and lots of other people.
The only other activities were the daily interrogations. Through a translator, Chinese men, women, and children were taken to a small room with a wooden desk and two chairs. They faced questioning about their lives back home and their relatives or friends in America. The interrogators were looking for any discrepancies in their stories so they could be used as reasons for deportation. Dale Ching was 16 when he arrived at Angel Island, and he remembers the fear and paranoia the interrogations brought.
Well, I was there for that many months, and I was waiting for the interrogation. When after interrogation, then we can more or less freely talk about things. Because after interrogation, we still worry about it, because some stranger might be a spy talking about the official. But you have to know who's who to talk to.
Ching now works as a docent for Angel Island, and on his tours, he talks about the lack of personal privacy.
You're going in to take a shower? No curtain. You're going into the toilet? You sit there and you come out and like that. No partition in between. The sleeping quarter, 10 o'clock, the light will go out every day. The light go out. No matter what you do, you got to go to bed. But the bathroom, yes, the light is on all the time, but it's kind of scary to go.
Ching was not alone in his reaction to the detention. Chinese detainees carved their responses all over the walls of the men's barracks.
So the poem reads, "Detained in the wooden house for several tens of days, it is all because of the Mexican exclusion law which implicates me. It is a pity heroes have no way of exercising their prowess."
Erica G. points out poetry written in Chinese characters now barely visible on the walls.
And then the second poem reads, "From now on, I'm departing from this building. All of my fellow villagers are rejoicing with me. Don't say that everything within is a Western style. Even if it's built of jade, it is turned into a cage."
A great deal of care went into creating this poetry. First, one man wrote it, then another carved the characters skillfully onto the barrack walls.
People were very aware at Angel Island that they were being discriminated against because they were Chinese and that they were unable to do anything about the situation.
Judy Young is the co-author of Island, Poetry and History of Chinese Immigrants on Angel Island. Along with Mark Him Lai and Jenny Lim, they documented the poetry and oral history of detainees.
All the poems in this collection we know were written by men because the poems by the women were in a building that was destroyed in the fire in 1940, so we have no records of poems by women. Many of the poems, I think, reflect a sense of sadness, depression, loneliness, because these are immigrants that were being detained for weeks and months at a time, and they were just feeling very frustrated and depressed and yearning to be freed or returned home.
Random thoughts deep at night. In the quiet of night, I heard faintly the whistling of wind. The forms and shadows saddened me. Upon seeing the landscape, I composed a poem. The floating clouds, the fog, darkened the sky. The moon shines faintly as the insects chirp. Grief and bitterness entwined are heaven sent. The sad person sits alone, leaning by a window.
The poetry conjures up images of male detainees carving onto walls as they lay in their bunk beds in overcrowded barracks. Some of the poetry, like The Weak Shall Conquer, talks about revenge for mistreatment.
Leaving behind my writing brush and removing my sword, I came to America. Who was to know two streams of tears would flow upon arriving here? If there comes a day when I shall have attained my ambition and become successful, I will certainly behead the barbarians and spare not a single blade of grass.
Judy Young considers the poetry an act of resistance and protest.
They are ways that the Chinese could vent their frustrations, express their anger, express how they feel that they've been wronged, and how they hope someday to seek revenge and to right the wrong. I think that it's one of the few evidences that we have of the early Chinese immigrants and what they thought about the Chinese Exclusion Act and the way that they were incarcerated at Angel Island Immigration Station. If you read some of the poems, it also says this is a record of what happened to us. It's also a way for us to tell those who will be following us what to expect and to console them and to encourage and support them. Especially if they bothered to carve them into the walls and not just penned or penciled them in. They must have thought about how this would be read by others. And I wonder if it isn't also a record of resistance for future generations.
That's what keeps Dale Ching giving tours to school children at Angel Island. He, like other former detainees, find it hard to even come back to face the fences that once locked them in.
Everybody, they mention Angel Island, they don't want to talk about it. I can see why they don't want to talk about it. At least I know I'm doing something. History is history.
Angel Island by Dimay Roberts and Michael Johnson. We had help from the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation. Find photos and links to all our stories at crossingeast.org. You're listening to Exclusion and Resistance on Crossing East. I'm George Takei.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm George Takei, your host for Crossing East. We're featuring stories about exclusion policies and resistance by Asian immigrants. During the dreaded immigration review process, Chinese immigrants were asked minute details about their family history and living conditions in China. Their answers had to agree with those of their sponsors and witnesses to prove their identities and right to enter the U.S. Since the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, every Chinese immigrant was interrogated in this way until 1943, when it was repealed. With poverty and political chaos in China, many Chinese looked to America for refuge. But with the Exclusion Act barring all but a few, Chinese immigrants had to find another way around the system. Children of parents who entered as paper sons still feel the sting of that interrogation process. Judy Young is a professor emeritus of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her father entered as a paper son, and her mother as a legitimate wife of a merchant. Chapter 3, Paper Sons.
For the record, what are all your names?
My Chinese name is Tom Bick Fong, but my birth certificate and everything else says that my name is Judy Young.
Your right to enter the United States will be considered by this board.
Because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, only certain classes of immigrants could come to the United States from China between 1882 and 1943.
The burden is upon you to prove that you are not subject to exclusion under any provision of the immigration laws, and all evidence in your behalf must be submitted at this hearing.
My father immigrated to America in 1921, 15 years old at the time. The way he came was that his uncle in the United States was able to buy papers that said he was the son of a merchant in Stockton by the name of Young Ung.
What are all your names?
So my father, whose name was Tom Yip Jing, his surname is Tom, came to the United States claiming to be Young Hing's son, the second son of this merchant in Stockton. The papers that were bought for him by his uncle cost $1,500, $100 for each year of age.
Advised as to the nature and penalty for the crime of perjury.
Immigration had no way of knowing who was coming in as a merchant or as a son or a wife of a U.S. citizen without putting them through some kind of interrogation or questioning.
For the record, why are you appearing here today?
The San Bruno, California National Archives branch has all of the Angel Island transcripts. And the reason why they kept all these files was that they had to recall files when new immigrants from the same family came through, so they would ask the same questions and see that there's a consistent pattern in terms of the responses about people's background and identities. So I was able to go there and find my mother and my father's immigration files and the transcripts of the interrogation.
What are all your names? Why are you appearing here today? Please describe the house of your maternal grandparents in which you were living at Macau.
And so those kinds of questions were asked of the immigrant, and then they would ask the same questions of the sponsor, whether it's their husband or their father, whoever was going to be the witness.
Why are you appearing here today? What are all the names you know for your husband?
And the answers had to agree.
Your wife states that the north kitchen skylight is not equipped with glass and that the smoke from the stove goes out through that skylight. What do you say to that?
One or two wrong answers could mean that you would be deportable.
What do you say to that? The burden is upon you. What are all the names you know for your husband?
And even people who were true sons and true wives would fail the examination because if the other person remembered differently. So people were really fearful of that interrogation, and they knew it was going to come, and they would have these coaching notes that they would memorize prior to even coming to this country in able to prepare for these examinations.
Alleged husband and father sworn and admonished that if at any time he should fail to understand the interpreter to immediately so state. Advised as to the nature and penalty for the crime of perjury.
Those who were of the merchant class who had the right to bring their wives and children to this country would claim that they had more children than they did, and then they would sell these identities to other fellow villagers so that they can come pose as sons and daughters of the merchant class. And then in 1906, the earthquake destroyed all the birth certificates, birth records at City Hall in San Francisco. Anyone who stepped forward and claimed that they were U.S. citizens would be believed, and they could then also report that not only were they a U.S. citizen, but they had four sons in China, which then created four slots by which they could sell these slots to others in China.
Applicant 1114 was too young to testify, but gave evidence of regarding Zhu Law Ying as her mother.
And I think to the day he died, he was always worried that he's going to be deported. So he told us never to tell anyone what our real surnames were and to never tell anyone who my father really is and where he really is from.
Testimony has been taken from the alleged wife, applicant 1113, and from Young Hin Sen concerning their marriage and subsequent stay together in China.
And when my mother came in 1940, my father was the witness, and so she was asked about 100 questions. He was asked the same 100 questions.
Your wife states that the north kitchen skylight is not equipped with glass. Please describe the house of your maternal grandparents in which you were living at Macau. What do you say to that?
I'm born in this country. I know I have rights, and I'm a U.S. citizen, and I know they can't deport me, but it's just that my father always drummed this into our heads. He always made us, you know, feel very afraid of immigration and of white authorities because we're illegals, and we knew this.
Advise as to the nature and penalty for the crime of perjury. Crime of perjury. Penalty for the crime of perjury.
Just shows us how complicated and how expensive and how arduous this whole process was for everybody concerned.
No discrepancies worthy of mention were brought out by the testimony.
The paper sun system was an act of resistance. It was an act of circumvention. Resistance can also be seen as finding ways to circumvent discriminatory and unfair laws to the Chinese immigrants. And I think what those immigration documents tell us is how people had to lie in order to circumvent that immigration exclusionary law to make it into this country.
Your right to enter the United States will be considered by this board. The burden is upon you to prove that you are not subject to exclusion under any provisions.
Paper Sons by Sarah Caswell Colbert featured Judy Young and testimonies of her parents, printed in her book, Unbound Voices. From 1907 to 1917, a few thousand men and a handful of women from the Punjab area in northern India made their way to North America. The Punjab was a rich agricultural region, but under British rule, many peasant farmers could not pay the high taxes. A famine from 1899 to 1903 decimated their cattle, and the farmers ended up losing their lands. There were Hindus and Muslims among those forced to seek their fortunes in America, but most were followers of the Sikh religion. Judge Brar's father, Kehar Singh, arrived in California in 1913.
Dad and my uncle Dal Singh landed in San Francisco, and they didn't have the $5 apiece to pay the port fee. And for $5, they turned them back. Now, $5 doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it was back then.
South Asians arrived in a society that first welcomed cheap labor, then excluded each Asian immigrant group in turn. By the early 1920s, Punjabis fleeing discrimination, racism, and religious persecution were looking to settle. They sought somewhere safe, somewhere rural, to worship and live in peace. That search played a key role in fighting a legal battle that would represent all Asians in America. Chapter 4, Defining American, by Sarah Caswell Colbert.
They worked as farmers. They made their way down California's coast until they settled in Clovis, which is near Fresno in California's Central Valley.
Filmmaker Valerie Kaur has been tracing her grandfather's history with the help of her father, Judge Brar.
Farmers would let them live in barns, and at first they were a little bit hesitant to give them work because they looked so different. My dad used to tell me how, you know, at first it was kind of difficult to get work.
Valerie Kaur named her film company New Moon Productions after the translation of the name of her grandfather's village in India. For her latest film, Divided We Fall, she interviewed her father about her grandfather, whom she calls Babaji.
Why do you think Babaji came to America?
Well, Valerie, I think in those days in India, it was the English that were ruling there, and they pretty much treated the Indians as slaves. My dad and my uncle decided to come here for a better opportunity.
Here in America, Kehar Singh faced legislated discrimination that was directed at all Asians, with special restrictions placed on South Asians.
Due to the Asian Exclusion Acts, my grandfather was not allowed to become a citizen. He was not allowed to own land. He was not allowed to leave the country because he would not be allowed back once he returned. So he could not marry an Indian wife.
The Chinese had the China Exclusion Act in 1882. In 1907, there was a gentleman's agreement between Theodore Roosevelt and the Emperor of Japan, which excluded Japanese. That same year, beginning in 1907, there were executive restrictions put in place by the president to limit the number of South Asians.
Jadeep Singh is a doctoral candidate in ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He points out the pattern of exclusion continued when California passed alien land laws in 1913 and 1920 that kept non-citizens from owning land.
And these laws were specifically directed at Asians, primarily Chinese and Japanese, but also South Asians to an extent. Of course, Asians were very clever and they found ways to evade these laws. For example, the 1913 law had a loophole.
So a lot of the Indians that came in those days married Mexican women or American women, mostly Mexican because they were very similar to Indian women as far as their cooking and their culture was somewhat similar. They would marry those women and they would buy the property in the women's name.
And what many Asians did was to place that land in the name of their children or of a friend's children who were American-born and therefore citizens by birth. By 1920, a second alien land law was passed in California, which closed that loophole. But you had these alien land laws throughout the country, including places like Kansas, that had almost no Asians.
Only citizens could own land, and only whites could become citizens. But two men had the courage to question the definition of white in the courts. Although their cases failed, they brought to light the racism of the court system at the time.
One year they say, you're white, but not Caucasian, and the next year they say, you're Caucasian, but not white.
By the 1920s, there was a fairly negative feeling in general about immigration to the United States from Asia.
Bruce LeBrac is a professor of anthropology and international studies at the University of the Pacific in California.
The first case in which this did deny citizenship to a group of people was the Ozawa case.
In which Ozawa came before the United States Supreme Court and said, look, I went to Berkeley High School, I went to the University of California, we speak English at home, my family goes to a Christian church, we are Americans in every way. He pointed to his skin, he said, look, my skin is actually much whiter than Southern Europeans who have been granted citizenship. So the Supreme Court said that you may be white, but you're not Caucasian.
In 1922, the court ruled against giving Japanese-born Takao Ozawa U.S. citizenship. It supported this decision by saying the founding fathers of America had only intended Caucasians to become citizens.
On the basis of that decision, there was a gentleman named Bhagat Singh Tind, who was a Sikh, who had served in the army in World War I, and he took the case to the Supreme Court, saying that the Indians, at least those in North India, were actually descendants of the original Aryans. They were, ethnologically speaking, biologically speaking, Europeans or Caucasians.
In 1923, Bhagat Singh Tind was denied citizenship by the Supreme Court. The court decided since the common man mistook the word Caucasian to mean white, being a biological Caucasian wasn't as important as being a free white person.
If you look at the case, it's actually really remarkable. The mental gymnastics that the Supreme Court goes through in order to justify racism. And so as a result of the Thin decision, several dozen South Asians retroactively lost their citizenship.
And they also lost the ability to own land. This was at a time when most Asian immigrants worked in agriculture. These land laws were in effect until after World War II.
As soon as the laws permitted my grandfather to own land, my grandfather bought 40 acres with his brother on Temperance and Bullard.
Valerie Kaur.
And he grew plums and peaches and strawberries. He lived in an old wooden house. There was no tractor. They still used horses. And my father was actually born on this land, and I was born on this land as well.
Judge Brar.
Well, my dad and my uncle, Dal Singh, did not get married until after 1947, and that's when the Asian Exclusion Act was lifted. And so they had an opportunity to go back to India and get married. My dad, of course, in 1950 got married to my mom. They came to this 40 acres that we're on right now.
How did everyone know him? What did everyone
Well,
think of him?
You got a picture. Now, you know, you see a lot of people with turbans and beards. In those days, I was the only Indian at my high school, the entire high school. So you can imagine my dad having a really white beard and wearing a turban. He was very distinctive, and people really liked him, and he knew everybody in town. He always loved this country. So in 72, when he became a citizen, he voted in the next election, and from there on, he never missed an opportunity to vote. And even when he got older, could barely walk, he would have me put him in the truck, and we'd go to the voting booth to vote.
Because her grandfather immigrated to the U.S. with the first wave of South Asians in the early 20th century, Valerie Kaur is one of the few third-generation Sikh Americans. In tracing the journey of Kehar Singh, she's found a connection with all Asian immigrants that shapes her definition of what it means to be American.
Even as the laws that kept my grandfather from becoming a citizen and from owning land were lifted in the 1940s, there have still been moments in our history, in American history, that have made my grandfather and people in my community targets of hate and violence. I think laws only get us so far. I think what is required is a change in the culture itself, to expand the circle of who looks like an American, to include all Americans, so that people with Japanese faces, Chinese faces, Sikhs, Muslims, are seen not as foreigners, not as perpetual foreigners, not as enemies to America, but part of the very American fabric. And the fact that my grandfather has been part of American history since the 1900s makes me believe that only if we can get these stories out to Americans to make them see how diverse the picture of an American really is, only then can we create a community of true respect and solidarity and strength.
Defining American by Catherine Stifter and Sarah Caswell Colbert, with contributing producers Deepa Ranganathan and Rupa Maria. In a moment, a look at the struggle to be a naturalized citizen.
January 1930, a mob attacked a Filipino bunkhouse. And people like Carlos Bulacan are organizing Filipino workers to fight for better wages and better conditions and also to agitate for citizenship. And so in 1934, the Tynes-McDuffie Act is passed and makes these people who are nationals into aliens. They lose this kind of elevated status above alien. And so it's this kind of 10-year limbo period for, you know, Filipinos in the United States, not really knowing what their status is going to be.
This is Crossing East. I'm George Takei. Find out more about our series at crossingeast.org.
Our actor in this segment of Crossing East was Andre Alcala as the interviewer. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm George Takei. This is Exclusion and Resistance on Crossing East. The Immigration Act of 1924 essentially cut off all immigration from Asia for 25 years. By the end of World War II, there were only about 1,500 Sikhs left in the United States. The 1924 Act also affected Filipinos who had been working in the U.S. The U.S. annexed and took over the Philippines after the Spanish-American War in 1898. Filipino bachelors easily entered the U.S. through the 1920s and 30s. They filled the need for cheap labor, working on the sugar plantations in Hawaii, farms in California's Central Valley, and in hotels and restaurants of major cities. But when the Depression hit, jobs were scarce. In 1934, Congress passed the Tidings-McDuffie Act, limiting Filipino immigration to just 50 people a year. Then, in 1935, came the Repatriation Act. Filipinos who volunteered to leave the country were given one-way tickets back to the Philippines if they agreed never to return. Chapter 5, Planting the Seeds of Citizenship, by Stephanie Loleng.
Eudocia Juanitas is a retired Stockton nurse who's small in stature but large in warmth and hospitality. She arrived from the Philippines in 1936.
I was born March 1st, 1911, so I'm 94 years old. There was a Filipino that lived in our place and he came for vacation. So I was looking for a wife. So I agreed.
Many of the immigrants had come expecting to stay only for a few years.
Don Mabalon is assistant professor in the history department at San Francisco State University.
They were going to work, they were going to become rich, they were going to get their college educations, and then they were going to return.
Max Lamar is in his 90s. He came to San Francisco in 1930. First, he bluffed his way into restaurant work, saying he was 18. Eventually, he worked on farms near Stockton.
I told them I was 18. I worked in a restaurant, Filipino restaurant. I put the dishes on the table. Oh, it's not counted hard work.
Max Lamar came to the U.S. as a bachelor.
I was young.
The majority of the population was male, the Filipino-American population before World War II.
Mabalon is third-generation Filipino-American. She grew up in Stockton's Little Manila and is chair of the Little Manila Foundation, a nonprofit organization that works to preserve Filipino history in Stockton.
The population is about 10% female. Up until the 1940s.
I came right away in the boat. That was in 1936.
Eudocia Juanitas followed her husband to the Central Valley of California, where he worked on a ranch as a labor contractor.
We stayed there in the ranch there for 5 years. They planted celery.
Filipinos kind of fill that labor vacuum. And in West Coast agriculture, they really become the engine for economic growth in California in the 1920s and 1930s.
My husband was in the farm. They have several men with him. Also in the packing house, I was in charge of taking care of the men that are packing celery. I did the bookkeeping there and watched the men. Even the women have to work in the farm, like packing something in the farm. We were not given high wages. I was receiving only 90 cents an hour at that time, but it was good enough, you know.
Max Lamar shared a small apartment not far from the place where he used to work. Rent was cheap.
You work that time, 8 hours, and then you go home, rest. Then during weekends, I go to dance halls.
Filipinos had been working in the Watsonville, Santa Cruz, Pajaro Valley area throughout the 1920s, becoming a very significant and powerful labor force in that area. In January 1930, it was learned that Filipinos were trying to create a dance hall where it was reported that they would, you know, have contact with white women, which enraged locals in Watsonville.
Monday to Friday, I work in a farm. Saturday, Sunday, I have good time, go to the dance.
Many Filipino men would go to dance halls, wear their finest suits, and mingle with white women.
That's the time when my loneliness go away.
January 1930, a mob attacked Filipino bunkhouse, and Fermin Tobera was killed when he was shot through the heart. People like Carlos Bulacan are organizing Filipino workers to fight for better wages and better conditions and also to agitate for citizenship.
Carlos Bulacan, in his book America is in the Heart, wrote about vigilant Filipino workers, their wholehearted support of the trade union movement, their hatred of low wages and other persecutions against them.
And so in 1934, the Tynes-McDuffie Act is passed. And so it makes these people who are nationals into alien. They lose this kind of elevated status above alien. And so it's this kind of 10-year limbo period for, you know, Filipinos in the United States, not really knowing what their status is going to be.
During World War II, I was inducted in the army, U.S. Army. I went to Honolulu, we stopped there for a while, and then straight to the Philippines. And my brothers and sisters, they introduced me to young Filipino women.
Jean Lamar, Max's wife, remembers the whirlwind romance during his visit to her hometown in the Philippines.
Oh my God, it was a one-month courtship. And at the same time, that's when we got married, September 16, 1945.
And then we have 5 children. 3 girls, 2 boys, married in the Philippines, lived there for how many years, and then came back to America.
The 1946 Loose Seller Act allowed Filipinos who were living in the U.S. to become naturalized citizens. The act was passed right at the end of World War II, after the Philippines was granted independence from the United States.
I work hard to be a citizen. Filipinos, they were good soldiers, very good fighters. So they allowed the Filipinos to be citizens. It's better to be a citizen.
Seeds of Citizenship by Stephanie Loleng with contributor Mia Kim. Citizenship is something that many Americans take for granted, but not the Nisei Japanese, who fought with extraordinary valor as members of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the most decorated unit to emerge from the Second World War. They fought even though their families were behind barbed wire incarceration in U.S. internment camps. The Chinese were allowed to become naturalized in 1943, and in 1946, Filipinos and South Asians. Then in 1952, with the McCarran-Walter Act, Koreans, and finally, after Nisei Valor, Japanese were allowed to become U.S. citizens. As the United States left Cambodia in 1975, Pol Pot and his deadly Khmer Rouge regime took control of the country and forced people to move into the countryside to work in what would be known as the killing fields. Those who tried to escape fled to the border of Thailand through minefields to make their way to refugee camps. Between 1975 and 1985, more than 700,000 Southeast Asians arrived in the U.S. 120,000 were Cambodians. Andrew T. was 6 years old when his parents and 4 sisters came to California. Though his family worked hard, Andrew still grew up in urban poverty. He wanted things he couldn't afford, and he got in trouble with the law for robbery and auto theft. And now, because of a 1996 immigration law, he faces deportation to a country he barely remembers. Our final chapter, Cambodian Deportation, by Robin Takayama.
My name is Andrew T. I am 30 years old. I came to America on September 81.
I'm just here to help out because my parent is getting old.
Yeah, he can do like the heavy stuff. Loading and mow the lawn, blower, and cut the tree.
It makes the job easier when you have helpers like as me, as his son, and have experience. It makes the job faster.
Andrew has been helping his dad with the gardening business since he was a little kid. His older sister, Singh, says their dad built the business up from nothing when they arrived in the United States.
My dad tried to go to school, learn basic English, and he would help do gardening, help the church and clean the church up, and they liked the way he worked. That's when he started cutting, you know, grasses and mowing lawn and cutting flowers, and they teach him.
In 1990, over 60% of all Southeast Asian households headed by refugees were on public assistance. That's three times the rate of African Americans and four times the rate of Latinos.
We was very poor. The way we survived, I mean, they give us welfare money. I mean, Medicare just to survive because, come on, we just came to America from Cambodia, you know what I mean?
We would wear, like, mismatched clothes. And the pants was just second-hand clothing. We got it from church.
In the beginning, there were sponsorship programs where the United States called on churches and community organizations to sponsor refugees.
Bill Hing is a professor of law and Asian American studies at UC Davis. He says the U.S. felt obligated to receive the thousands of refugees fleeing the Khmer Rouge. However, he believes the federal government's resettlement plan failed in helping refugees adapt to life in America.
It really was up to the federal government to come up with any other programs. The only kind of programs they really had during those first 10-year periods were a little bit of language training and job training. The rest of your life in that neighborhood, in that community, it's entirely up to you.
Pertira Chim worked with refugees at Cambodian Community Development Inc. in Oakland, California. He says the resettlement plan lacked much-needed mental health and social services, and parents were too overwhelmed with issues of survival to even consider becoming naturalized citizens.
These are folks that suffered through mass starvation, that were highly traumatized, that were called to be farmers and told not to learn by, you know, a regime that murdered you if you were educated whatsoever. And they were expected to come to America and learn history and learn how to read and write when many of these folks didn't know how to read and write in Cambodian. And so, you know, there's a lot of obstacles faced by folks like Andrew.
Maybe it's just the environment is the way your surroundings, the poverty, the place. That's why all the bad things, just crimes, theft.
Andrew, who was an honor student and received a scholarship to attend Cal State Hayward, laughs nervously when he recalls the time his life turned in the wrong direction.
I remember my first thing I ever stole was a token from the Malibu Grand Prix, like a car race place. You pop the token machine, you reach your hand, you stole the token, you could take the token, go sell, make money back. It was like, I got addicted to it. Living in a poverty area, you're not 16 yet, you can't get a license yet. It's just a lifestyle of a teen, you know what I mean? You want to get around, you want to hang around, you want to take your girls out, you know what I mean? You don't have the patience to wait for your parents, wait for the bus. Hey, you need a ride? Get it right there.
I guess maybe he just started hanging around with the wrong friends, and then he's just stealing cars. My dad warned him, you know, what have you been doing? You better stop. And then you might go to jail for a long, long time. My dad did warn him about that. And I guess he didn't really listen.
My first time I got caught was my sophomore year in high school. I got caught, I mean, stealing cars, joyriding, doing what I gotta do just to have fun. And when I got caught, they sent me to 6 months in camp. Then I go on a home pass, I do some more car burglary, got caught again. Then they sent me almost 2 years total, my first time in juvenile halls. Then I got caught for a robbery somewhere in L.A. It cost me 5 years in prison.
Bill Hing.
For many, many years now, policymakers and the public, I suppose, are upset when they hear that there are immigrants that commit crimes. And that's been embodied in the immigration laws so that since 1986, there's been additions made to the law to broaden when people can be deported for criminal convictions.
With our situation, not being a citizen, it's totally different from people that being a citizen, right? The unfortunate thing about the Asian is that when you commit crime and you're not a citizen, you finish doing your time, there's another process you have to handle. It's called INS. They will take your paper and they'll ship you back to your country. It doesn't matter how long you've been here.
But prior to 1996, you had a chance to ask a judge, an immigration judge, for a waiver, for forgiveness, basically. Your Honor, let me stay in the United States. I've learned my lesson. I'm rehabilitated now. And if the judge believed you, the judge could grant this waiver and give you your green card back. Well, in 1996, Congress felt that that possibility was too generous. So Congress took away that possibility from any aggravated felon.
Patira Chim.
In many ways, the laws out of 1996 was targeted at, it wasn't just immigration, but welfare reform. And it was clear that America was telling immigrants that we don't care about you and that we blame you for our welfare ills.
They could take your life anytime they want by the pick of the draw, the name. To me, sometimes I just feel so helpless. You know what I mean? Like, wow, when is my name called up?
Now he waits for the Immigration and Naturalization Service, currently under the Department of Homeland Security, to call. Although there are more than 1,500 Cambodian Americans to be deported, Cambodia is only accepting a small number each month. So deportees like Andrew do their best to carry on their lives until they are notified their deportation date is scheduled.
I got to face the music when it's time to go. But see, that's the weak point, but it's like you don't know when it is. It might be the next day. You know, to be honest with you, it might be when I get home. And what can you do?
If they're going to deport my brother back to Cambodia, it's going to be really hard because my dad, he traveled 2 feet, walking through muds and through dead body, and he does everything for us to try to get away from that.
I wasn't born here. I was granted to live here, to earn a new life. And I made the wrong choice. I mean, they didn't put a gun to my head, you got to do this. No, it was my choice. I made it to make some little money, to get better things. But I would do something in my power to show to America, to the world, to the society, to the community, I am a changed person. I mean, everything I do every day is good.
Can do it. You can leave. I can finish it up. Don't worry about that.
Before, I don't even plan for the future, right? But now I look at the bright side. Whatever happens. That's what it's meant to be. I mean, but while I'm still here, I'm gonna make the best of my life and go forward with it.
Cambodian Deportation by Robin Takayama with contributor Mia Kim. We came in many ways, always in search of the American dream, and always excluded. We rose up against injustice and raised new generations of Americans. These are our stories, our history, our America. I've been your host, George Takei.
Crossing East is produced with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and individual donors of Meteorites Productions. Special thanks to Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation and to KQED FM in San Francisco. Our theme music is by Shasta Tycho from their CD Spirit Drum, with additional music by John Jang from his CD Two Flowers on a Stem, and from Angelo Pizarro. Our lead scholar is Judy Young, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. The managing editor is Catherine Stifter. The associate producer is Sarah Caswell-Colbert. The Crossing East engineer is Clark Salisbury, with technical assistance by Michael Johnson. The marketing and outreach director is Ping Ka. The executive producer is D-May Roberts. To find out more about Crossing East and this program, go to crossingeast.org. Support for Crossing East comes from this station and Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Series Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.